We had come then late in the first century to the end years of the Apostle John. As the first century comes to a close, the church had been through its many ups and downs, but really after the death of Peter and Paul in the 60s and then the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 AD, the church never had the same organization and structure that it did prior to those events. John did, of course, maintain the faith. And there was a great deal of growth, but in all probability, what we now pick up and begin to read about in church history probably chronicles the development of a false system of Christianity more than it does God's true church. And as I've commented three or four times already, we have such scanty evidence available in this period of time that it's very hard to draw conclusions. But I do want to read you a number of events. Today's class will involve a lot of reading to you, to save you the time from having to go ferret this out of the books, but I felt like it might be easier for me just to read it out of those books than to try to lecture from it, so you can get a picture of what was happening during this period of time. The Roman Caesar, late in the century, Domitian, was 81 to 96, I think I gave you that date last time. Thus, he was the Roman Caesar who dealt with the Apostle John. Now, what we have as Domitian's dealing with John are not scriptures. We cannot know for sure whether these things happened or not. When you read through them, you'll say, I don't know if that happened that way or not. You just kind of get a funny feeling. But these are traditions that have been preserved, and they may or may not have happened. So we read them for what it's worth department type of a thing. And I would caution that we would not teach them as doctrine or truth, or this is the way it happened. Except some of those things we know are confirmed by the Bible. That is, we know John was on the Isle of Patmos. He says so in the scripture, and we'll read how that came to be, how that came to pass, as we go along in the early part of the class today. Let's read a little bit about Domitian, the Caesar, in his time, so you get a feel of the man, because he was very important in dealing with the early church. This is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. On Domitian. Like Augustus, he attempted a reform of morals and religion. As chief pontiff, he inquired rigorously into the character of the Vestal Virgins, three of whom were buried alive. In spite of all you've heard, in reality, Vestal Virgins in the time of Rome were indeed virgins. It was very important to them, if they were selected for that, to maintain their chastity after they served their time in the temple. Then they may not have remained pure, but at least it was a very high honor. Domitian enforced those things. There was a bit of a reform here under Domitian in Rome, in other words. He enforced the laws against adultery, mutilation, and the grosser forms of immorality, and forbade the public acting of mimes. It's funny how people will consider some things important in their moral standards, and others we would not give any attempt to at all. However, the mimes often acted pornographically. It was the nearest thing to pornography that they had in those days, I suppose, publicly. He passed many sumptuary laws and issued an edict forbidding the over-cultivation of vines to the neglect of corn growing. In other words, there was a great wine production, but food shortage of food production was not what it ought to be. So you should see a little bit about the man. Domitian's military achievements were insignificant. The revolt of Antonius Saturnius, the commander of the Roman forces in Upper Germany in 88 or 89, marks the turning point in his reign. From that moment, Domitian's character changed. He got rid of all whom he disliked on the charge of having taken part in the conspiracy, and no man of eminence was safe against him. He was in constant fear of assassination and distrusted everyone around him. During the last 3 years of his life, his behavior was that of a madman. He sentenced to death his own cousin and nephew by marriage, Flavius Clemens, whose wife he banished for her supposed leanings toward Christianity. Finally, he was stabbed in his bedroom by a freedman of Clemens named Stephanus on the 18th of September in 96. So it gives you an idea of the frame of mind of this man. At the time, he would have been dealing with the Christian growth and the empire in the 90s, and then a personal confrontation with the Apostle John. In a work entitled The Lives of the Twelve Caesars, you don't need to worry about that, just read you a little bit more. Domitian, Vespasian's son, was born in Rome and lived a scandalous youth. He constantly plotted against his brother for power and position. In the beginning of his reign, he used to spend daily an hour by himself in private, during which time he did nothing else but catch flies and stick them through their bodies with a sharp pin. Great people that have ruled the world. He levied a poll tax on Jews, which was strictly enforced. I remember when I was a youth, when an old man 90 years of age had his person exposed to view in the very crowded court in order that on inspection the procurator could satisfy whether or not he was circumcised and a Jew. His egotism extended to regulating the height and weight of his statues. So, again, these are things that just give you an indication of the character of the man. How he came to view Christians from the Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religion. You should be familiar with the name of that work. A major work of religious study. The Schaff-Herzog, that's a hyphenated word, S-C-H-A-F-F hyphen H-E-R-Z-O-G, Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religion, explains his views on Christians. Roman custom permitted a virtual decision to be rendered against a whole group of persons who were believed to be banded together to commit crimes. No overt act needed, therefore, to be proved against any individual member of the group in order to ensure his condemnation. The exact charges varied with local circumstances, but by the middle of the second century, the common charge, that is against Christians, came to be treason-atheism, based on their refusal to participate in the imperial cult. And who knows how many hundreds, if not thousands, of Christians died late in the first and on through the middle of the second century at Roman hands because of the charge they were Christians, and the charge leveled against the entire group of Christians was treason atheism. So all you had to do was be convicted or even speculated of being a Christian, and you could be, depending on the local circumstances, subject to torture and or death, and many were. In another work entitled Early Church History, again, this is not important. The work is entitled Early Church History by Benko, B-E-N-K-O, if you want to write it down. That Christians may have been a special object of Domitian's persecution is also attested by Tertullian. Domitian, too, a man Nero's type in cruelty, tried his hand at persecution. But as he had something human in him, he soon put an end to what he had begun, even restoring again those whom he had banished. So in spite of all these things about this man, he did have a certain human quality, humanism about him, and he did not always carry through to the end that which he even allowed. It was, however, as I've already mentioned, a terrible time. You may be familiar with Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is not necessarily light reading, but some of you at least may want to own the book for its general expose of martyrdom and man's inhumanity to man, especially in the light of religion over the centuries. Fox's Book of Martyrs says of this time, the tyrants and organs of Satan were not content with death only, to bereave the life from the body. The kinds of death were diverse, and no less horrible than diverse. Whatsoever the cruelness of man's invention could devise for the punishment of man's body was practiced against Christians in this time. Stripes and scourgings, drawings, tearing, stonings, plates of iron laid unto them burning hot, deep dungeons, racks, strangling in prison, the teeth of wild beasts, gridirons, gibbets and gallows, tossing of the horns upon the horns of bulls. This is a bit gruesome, but this is what happened to our brethren in that century. Moreover, they were thus killed, their bodies laid in heaps, and dogs were left to keep them, that no man might come to bury them, neither could any prayer be obtained for them to be interred. So it was a pretty gruesome time that existed in the early part of the second century to the mid part of the second century. And it was in this context that John had to carry out his work. As an old man, interestingly enough, although this is not to presume he was a weak old man, but we know little about him in his physical stature, except that he was the one man we know to live this long. We presume he was the only apostle to live out a normal lifespan. It is, again, assumed, although we don't know in every case, that the other apostles were martyred. We know Peter and Paul were, and others too. James, the Lord's brother, not one of the original 12. Well, we know one of the original 12 was, because he was the first to be martyred. That's recorded in the book of Acts. John also lived to see the rise of the Gnostic movement under Cerinthus. I've mentioned that man's name a few times. There is a story. It is perhaps apocryphal. We don't know if it's true or not. I could sort of see it happening, but maybe it didn't. But when John was an old man in the 90s, he was with a young student who will become very important to church history named Polycarp. We'll come to him, I hope, before today's class is over. Polycarp and John, as the story goes, went to the public baths. This is not unusual because that's the way it was done in those days. Homes did not have private baths, but there were steam houses and baths that were public. Men's and ladies' separate accommodations for the most part, although in some more sordid parts of society, I suppose they were intermingled. But at one occasion, in a steamy bathhouse, it was said that John and Polycarp had gone, and they noticed through the haze, Cerinthus was in the same bathhouse with them. And it is alleged that John said at the time, "Let us flee, lest the bath fall in, while Cerinthus, the enemy of truth, is within." And so John left and wouldn't even take a bath with this arch-heretic named Cerinthus, who was perverting Christianity and bringing in Gnostic doctrines and a lot of heresy. I could again see that type of a thing. I don't know. I tried to picture, you know, Mr. Armstrong, you know, would he, if he ended up in the same public place as the Pope, would he leave? I don't know if he would or not. I suppose, given the right set of circumstances, it would be appropriate to even meet with and talk with such a representative of another religious organization, whether it be the president of a major church or another television evangelist. I wouldn't run fleeing from them necessarily, but John, suspecting that the bath would collapse because of this man, didn't want to be there when it did. It depends on how you feel about them, I guess, these kind of things. So whether, again, that's true or not, I don't know. There is a tradition, then, that John was arrested as a Christian by the Emperor Domitian, and at some point, it is not clear, apparently was taken to Rome, or at least met with the emperor. And a rather interesting story ensues, again, that may not totally be true, but I'll read you some of the incidents that happened. One tradition is that he was condemned to be put to death by being dipped in burning oil, and that event did take place, but nothing happened to him, which would get the attention, of course, of the emperor if he watched such an event take place or heard about such an event take place. Whether, again, that happened or not, I don't know. These traditions come from a little later period of time in the 2nd and 3rd century, so you don't know if it just kind of got exaggerated as time went by or not. One author writes, and I'm not going to mention the names of all of these places, because some of them are very obscure. He writes, speaking of Rome, how fortunate it is that the church upon which the apostles poured their whole teaching together with their blood, where Peter suffered like his Lord, where Paul was crowned with John's death, where the apostle John, after he had been immersed in boiling oil without harm, was banished to an island. And we know he was banished to an island. This is what Tertullian, one of the early writers, the Catholic writers, said. That was sort of the introduction to this tradition. It obviously, at the time of Tertullian, was a tradition which he preserved by writing, but the story is not told in that great a detail. Here is an account in the Ante-Nicene Fathers, which is a large work that I've mentioned before in the library. You can read in the library, not one to own, in general. That tells the story of John's meeting with Domitian. So it's a little bit long, but I want to read it. The fame of the teaching of John was spread abroad in Rome, and it came to the ears of Domitian that there was a certain Hebrew in Ephesus, John by name, who spread a report about the seat of the empire of the Romans, saying that it would quickly be rooted out and that the kingdom of the Romans would be given over to another. Now, you could imagine John saying that. It's a, you know, the kingdom of God is going to replace the kingdoms of men. And we don't know how much understanding Christ gave the apostles about the four successive world-ruling kingdoms from Babylon to Rome, but if he did give them that information, we might presume they had some of it, then they were in the kingdom of Rome. What they may not have known at first was that Rome was going to exist for more than 2,000 years before the kingdom was established. Although it's an interesting story that now ensues, and Domitian's confrontation with John is over the doctrine of the kingdom of God, and whether or not the Roman kingdom is going to be put down and another replacing it. So, they met. The king said to him, "Are you John, who said that my kingdom would speedily be uprooted, that another king, Jesus, was going to reign instead of me?" John answered and said to him, now this, you know, was interesting, "You also shall reign for many years given to you by God, and after you very many others. And when the times of the things upon earth have been fulfilled, out of heaven shall come a king, eternal, true judge of living and dead, to whom every nation and tribe shall conform, through whom every earthly power and dominion shall be brought to nothing, and every mouth speaking great things shall be shut." You can't disagree with anything there, you know. It sort of gives you the idea that John, by then, had the realization that this was not going to be the time of the establishment of the kingdom, that many more would come, although I'm sure he did not see at all. And this is apparently before his banishment, thus the book of Revelation was not given to him yet at the time he said this. At this, Domitian said to him, "What is your proof of these things? I am not persuaded by words only." Now here's where you wonder if this now happens. And immediately John asked for a deadly poison. The king, having ordered poison to be given to him, they brought it on the instant. John, therefore, having taken it, put it into a large cup and filled it with water and mixed it, and cried out with a loud voice and said, "In your name, Jesus Christ, Son of God, I drink the cup which you will sweeten, and the poison in it do you mingle with the Holy Spirit." And when John stood cheerful and talked with him safe, Domitian was enraged against those who had given him the poison as having spared John. Of course, he suspected a trick, in other words. John said, "Let a trial be made." Now, I can't imagine a servant of God doing this, so I wonder about the whole story. John said, "Let a trial be made, and you shall learn the power of the poison. Make some condemned criminal be brought before me from prison." And when he had come, John put water in the cup, swirled it around, and gave it with all the dregs to the condemned criminal. And he, having taken it and drunk, immediately fell down and died. So it proved it was poison, after all. Later, after Domitian ordered the dead body thrown away, John, going to the dead body, and having taken him by the hand, raised him up alive. And I guess if you're going to let, a man die, you feel obligated not to be responsible for his death, you better have faith you can raise him up. Again, whether John did this or not, I don't know. It makes a good story, though. And when all were glorifying God and wondering at the faith of John, Domitian said to him, "I have put forth a decree of the Senate that all such persons should be summarily dealt with without trial. But since I find from you that they are innocent and that their religion is rather beneficial, I banish you to an island, that I may not seem myself to do away with my own decrees." And that's the alleged story of how John got banished to the Isle of Patmos. Coupled with the burning oil incident, apparently. Though you read about them both somewhat in separate incidences a little bit. So, this is a bit of a difficulty to know what happened. It was the Isle of Patmos as a prisoner that God gave John the book of Revelation. He was then released from the Isle of Patmos and spent his last years at the turn of the century, apparently training the man who would succeed him, as much as we can glean from history, a man named Polycarp. How much Christianity had grown at this time is an interesting thought. Here's just one little comment from a book entitled The New Testament Era by Reiche, and again, that's not an important book to know. "Since pre-Christian and apostolic times, the Jewish people were represented in all important regions of the Roman and Parthian empires. Including proselytes, it numbered 7 million and made up between 6% and 9% of the total Roman Empire." So the Jewish population was rather significant. Remember, I pointed out how in the confines of the Jewish people, the church generally grew because it started often in at least the synagogues of the Jews and spread into the communities, and as a result of Sabbath keeping and the other laws of Judaism that would have been observed in part at least by the Christians, it was never perceived who they were. So mingled with maybe as much as 6% to 9% of the entire population of the Roman Empire. That's a significant number of people. You could see why Christians could grow up as a group not being as noticed. Let's say that would be not quite as large as the black population of the United States, as an example, which runs just over 10, maybe, what is it, 12, 13%. I think the Hispanic population is now climbing around 8, 9%, something like that, of our nation. And in other words, it's a significant enough number that any one thing happening in it would not appear to be that different if it didn't cause any major troubles. And of course, now by 100, it was a problem. We don't know how those things were going. Now, the emperor that succeeded Domitian was Trajan, T-R-A-J-A-N. He was 98 to 117, and he generally dealt very strictly with the Christians' community, too. I think I will just refer to him and not read a lot about him for sake of time here. Tacitus, the Roman historian, said of Trajan, he refers to the new religion as evil, hideous, and shameful, and noted for its hatred against mankind. Now the century has turned, John is dead, Christianity is still continuing to grow, but remember, it's got two, maybe three or four different branches almost of it, different kinds of Christianity is happening now, and we don't know who they're talking about in every case, but at the time of Trajan, one of the Roman historians said that this is how Christianity had come to be viewed. Continuing, Latin name I won't try to read except the last name is Felix, describes what the public suspected went on in private Christian meetings. And this is out of the writings of Tacitus, so you want to check it up. I have it quoted from another source, so I don't have Tacitus' original page numbering in here. It's probably different from edition to edition anyway. But in Tacitus, here is how the Roman public began to view Christianity and what they heard about it. And I think you can sort of see when you picture what people say about us, or about each other as far as that goes, and how rumors spread. An infant is covered, this is what they thought went on in their private meetings, an infant is covered with meal that it may deceive the unwary, is placed before him who is stained with their rites. This infant is slain by the young people who has been urged on it as if to a harmless blows on the surface of the meal with dark and secret wounds. And that's what the Romans accused Christians of doing, of wrapping a baby up, telling some unsuspecting person that it was meal and having him beat it and pound it, and of course the baby would die. That's just obviously not something that happened in the Christian community. I don't think this even happened in the worst of the Christian communities. But this is how the Romans thought they did. And one of the reasons they treated them the way they did. And he continued, thirsty, oh horror, they lick its blood, eagerly they divide its limbs. Now you just know that didn't happen, as grotesque as it is. You'd think even somebody with the sense of education of a Tacitus would not repeat the story, but it's recorded in history, and that's how Christians were viewed at this time. And I guess it gives you a feeling of what was said, but you know how rumors go around. Public opinion now rapidly began to change. And I'll read you a couple of comments here. Many wanted Christianity stopped, yet it spread. Personal contact and example, rather than elaborate missionary machinery, illustrated the faith of the world. Justin Martyr, who was one of the early Catholic writers, remember, says, many changed their violent and tyrannical disposition, being overcome either by the constancy with which they witnessed in the lives of their Christian neighbors, or by the extraordinary forbearance that they observed in their Christian fellow travelers when defrauded, and having by the honesty of those believers with whom they transacted business. In other words, evangelism, as we knew it with Paul, maybe John to a lesser degree, seemed to now be slowing, and that Christianity was spread pretty much by the personal example of others. And this is not to presume that just because they were of the Cerinthian movement or followers of the old Simon Magus group out of the 40s and 50s, that they were bad people. They may have indeed embraced Christian precepts in part. Just the same way we would say today, there are Baptist or Presbyterians or Catholic peoples who are humanitarian peoples, who are good people as that goes. and who strive as much as they know how to live a life based on the standards of God's Word. They don't always understand. So we should not presume when we say Gnostic or Cerinthus or even Simon Magus that we're dealing with some kind of a murderous tyrant. We're maybe dealing with groups or peoples that are striving to apply at least portions of Christian principles. And those things were growing during that period of time. I do have a handout that we are preparing for you. I hope will be ready next time, but we're having to make some corrections in it. And then sometimes the Xeroxing is the duplicating department is a little behind. Where I have Xerox letters from Pliny, who is a Roman lawyer, remember, stationed out on the Eastern Front representing Trajan, and his writings back about the Christians. So you'll have that, and I think the writings of Tertullian as well, that I have 6 or 7 pages of handouts, so you can have what I consider to be the most important documentation about Christians at this period of time, at least from those two perspectives. So I will not take the time to read all of that to you here in class, but hope that it will be ready for you next time, and you'll have to apply it into today's notes relevant to where you want to place it. I will read one brief paragraph from Pliny, though, because it's very important. This is early 2nd century. In the time of the Emperor Trajan, Pliny is a historian lawyer in Asia, writing about Christians back to his emperor. The method I have observed toward those who have been denounced to me as Christians is this, he said. I interrogated them whether they are Christians. If they confessed, I repeated the question twice again, against the threat of capital punishment. If they still persevered, I ordered them to be executed. For I was persuaded that whatever the nature of their creed, the contumacious and inflexible obstinacy certainly deserved chastisement. I judged it so much the more necessary to extract the real truth with the assistance of torture. From two female slaves whom they call deaconesses. But I could discover nothing but depraved and excessive superstition. I therefore thought it proper to adjourn all further proceedings in this affair in order to consult you. In other words, when he got out there, he did execute some, he did torture some, but he could find nothing wrong with them. And so he's writing back to Trajan and saying, what do you want me to do? I'm killing people, and I can't find any reason to kill them except that they're Christians and they've got superstitions. So it's an interesting, let's say, observation from the secular sources, and one of the prime, and those are relatively small and obscure things we have about Christians during this period of time. That's from Pliny. During the reign of Trajan, the Jews once again revolted in Judea and incurred the wrath of the Roman armies. This is called in history the Second Jewish War. The first was at the time of the fall of Jerusalem. Now, earlier in the second century, the Jews revolt again, and it is this time that the Romans just destroyed Judea. It was a mess, and Jerusalem was just hardly a city at all. They changed the name of it to Palestine or Palestinia. That's why the Jews, by the way, don't like the term. If you are not aware of it, I should mention to you, in dealing or speaking with Jewish people and or traveling in Judea or Israel today, much better not to use the term Palestine. It is an old Roman term given to the city upon its destruction, and it is not viewed by the Jews as very pleasant. They do not call it Palestine. It is Israel. So try to keep that in mind if you ever travel in that part of the world. It is not an affectionate term to the Jews, and they do not use the term to refer to that part of the world. As a result of that, Christians were pretty much expelled from Judea along with Jews at this time. So by this second century, by early part of the second century, we know that the primary body of Christians had already fled out of Jerusalem. Now they have to flee out of Judea. And there are not many left in that area. Antioch becomes one of the key cities, as it had been now for some little time. Remember, this is where Paul and Barnabas headquartered for their work, primarily, when they were in that part of the world. Up in Antioch, a principal city in the world. Peter had probably been there too. And then John, Polycarp were out in Asia Minor in the Seven Church area. There is a man, I won't comment much about him, but you should just be familiar in passing with another name in church history. The Bishop of the Church of Antioch, this is the title given to him in church history. Bishop of the Church at Antioch, his name was Ignatius. I-G-N-A-T-I-U-S. Not much is known about him, except that he was a primary bishop of the church. Not enough is known, for me at least, to feel comfortable about saying I think he was a minister of God's true church, or I think he was a part of the growing division that was occurring at this time. I simply don't know. We'll mention him as an unknown figure, but from the point of view of a name, he is one of the best known names. You see his name in church history. The 11th edition Encyclopedia Britannica says of Ignatius, "No one connected with the history of the early Christian church is more famous than Ignatius. And yet among the leading churchmen of the time, there is scarcely one about whose career we know so little." Eusebius, that's an historian of the early 4th century, Eusebius states that he was second successor of Peter in the bishopric of Antioch. So even the Catholics are admitting Peter is in the East. I don't know why they've got him in Rome, making him the first pope in the successive line of the papacy. He was, perhaps, I think, no reason to assume that he would not have been headquartered out of Antioch. When the persecution in Jerusalem forced his movement out of there. Besides, remember, Peter was not stationed in Jerusalem anyway. That's where James, the Lord's brother, was, and Peter was out amongst the Jewish people. It would have been natural for him to headquarter out of Antioch, the principal city of the Middle East, for transportation and travel, just as Paul had done. Paul was then out and away from there most of the time, so a little later, before their martyrdoms, Peter probably was the bishop at Antioch. No reason to assume not. And Ignatius may well have been his successor. It's interesting when you read about it, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, that by this time you see a deterioration in the government and authority, which I think is pretty logical after the death of all the apostles. What happens with men who have come along, who have not been trained by Christ personally, but have been trained by that generation who was, but they are not, perhaps, of the same strength of those people. And Ignatius makes a lot to do, what little we know about him, about the office of the ministry. I think he saw the power of the ministry was not as strong without the personalities of a James, a John, or a Paul as a part of it. And he didn't seem to have that much himself, so he tries to center the personality of the church in the ministry. Ignatius, this is still continuing from the Encyclopedia Britannica, Ignatius constantly contends for the recognition of the authority of the ministers of the church. "Do nothing without the bishop and the presbyters," he said. "It is not lawful apart from the bishop to baptize or to hold love feasts." Differences of theological opinion were arising. Churches had a tendency to split up into sections. The age of the apostles had passed away, and their successors did not inherit their authority. This is the Encyclopedia Britannica's analysis of what was happening. The unity of the churches was in danger. Ignatius was resisting the fatal tendency which threatens to ruin the faith. The only remedy for it in those days was to exalt the authority of the ministry and to make it the center of church life. And thus you have really the beginnings of what came to be centered in Rome. The power of the ministry of the church and the hierarchical structure, which had its right part, had its correct part, but was transferred to Rome later. The bishops at Rome were not now in authority. Ignatius is probably the strongest personality in the church early in the second century. Polycarp becomes the main personality, the dominant personality of the middle part of the second century. Whether Ignatius, again, was a true Christian or not, I don't know. He also was arrested by the Romans in Antioch, and he was shipped to Rome to die in the arena at Rome, probably in the Colosseum, perhaps the Circus Maximus, where he was condemned to fight with wild beasts. Most unpleasant thought. He said at the time of his death, "I bid all men know that my own free will I die for God, unless you should hinder me. Let me be given to the wild beasts, for through them I can attain unto God. I am God's wheat, and I am ground by the wild beasts, that I may be found pure bread of Christ. Entice the wild beasts, that they may become my sepulcher. Come fire and cross, and grapplings with wild beasts, wrenching of bones, hacking of limbs, crushing of my whole body, only to be mine to attain unto Jesus Christ. Again, a bit gruesome, but he knew what was going to happen to him, and he entered into the arena and died. And that event is recorded by the historians, again, but little else is known about it. Just a little bit about his organization and the ministry in the East. There is a tradition that on his way to Rome, he did meet with the bishop, Polycarp, and I use bishop in the traditional sense of the word. We simply would substitute the word minister for that, I think. But whether that really happened or not, I don't know. So now the scene shifts to Polycarp. In the Western Asia Minor area, Polycarp was born, apparently, of parents who were members of the church, probably converted during the ministry of Paul, whether directly through him or not, we don't know. About the time of the fall of Jerusalem, 69 or 70 AD. That's tradition, again, where we don't know this. This is a deduction, because Polycarp said upon his death that he had been serving Christ 86 years. And that is presumed to be his age at death. Now, it could be his age or his number of years of service from conversion, too. And thus, he could have been himself a man approaching 100 or more than 100 years of age. The general assumption, however, is that he meant he was born a Christian, born into the Christian family, and that he was a second-generation Christian. See, not all second-generation Christians have to be put down. None should be, but some are. So don't you do anything to be. But Polycarp, we presume, grew up a Christian. Thus, he would have been around his late 20s and early 30s when he was working with the Apostle John, prior to John's death, and he lived on to about 156. That's not an exact date, but because you're going to read, if you study Polycarp, you're going to read about his death any time from the middle 140s to the middle 160s, in fact. But in studying through it, I think 156 is probably the best date to pick. You should, however, know that that's subject to some controversy. So he was trained by John. He continued his work primarily headquartered out of the city of Smyrna. The Encyclopedia Britannica says about him, Polycarp was bishop of Smyrna and one of the apostolic fathers. So this is as the Catholics view him. Now the Catholics view Polycarp and any other who were Christians during this time as a part of their own hierarchical structure, as a part of their own bishopric, because they only recognized the development of one Christian church that was fragmenting, but that in the 4th century had to be brought under the control of Rome and the doctrines of Rome, and finally put out all the Judaistic heresy that had remained from the earliest times. They saw, in other words, the changing necessity of the authority of Rome and the worshiping of Sunday as an honor of the Lord's Day type of a thing. So he is viewed as a Catholic father, as indeed are all of these people. But what I read of Polycarp, I probably won't get to it quite today, but we'll see. But by the next time, you'll see why I think Polycarp was a true servant of Christ, was the, let's say, last vestige of the Ephesian remnant of the church. Although some people might want to count him as the beginning of the next era. Remember, I said I was not going to be able to define the beginnings and endings of eras except that which we're certain of. Like the beginning of the Ephesian era, we can nail down to the day. That's Pentecost 31. When did it end? I think Polycarp is still sort of the last tag of the Ephesian era of the church. And with him, it comes to a close. On the other hand, you may wish to bring the curtain down with John and pick up the next era of the church with Polycarp. I'd say, since God doesn't define it, it must not be important for us to know exactly, but it's just, we can view it either way. So the encyclopedia says he derives much of his importance from the fact that he links together the apostolic age and that of the nascent of Catholicism. Interesting observation by the Encyclopedia Britannica. They see Polycarp linking together the apostolic age, on the one hand, with the birth of Catholicism. And I think, you know, I've come to that conclusion apart from realizing that statement, but I think that really summarizes best what happened. We are now seeing Catholicism's start. Now, I know you can start it, and we properly should. We can see the roots going back to Simon Magus and what was happening. I don't dispute that. I think that's exactly what happened. But the solidification, the real birth of Catholicism, is now occurring in the days of Polycarp as the bishop at Rome takes on importance for the first time. Prior to Polycarp's time, there is no major emphasis on the bishop at Rome. But with Polycarp, and I'll tell you that story in the next class, I'm sure now, the way it'll turn out, you have the confrontation of bishops in the East represented by Polycarp and bishops in the West represented by the bishop of the church at Rome, whose name was Anicetus. And I'll say that enough times in the next class that you'll hear it a few times. Anicetus, who was bishop at Rome. So you really have, in a sense, the beginning, the early birth of Catholicism at about this time. And Polycarp bridges that gap, struggled against it, but didn't know how, it appears from the writings, to struggle against it, accepted it, and could not recognize what it was to become, and died not knowing what was then going to happen and how much power that church in Rome was going to gain within another 150 years, because it took that long for the power to solidify. The Encyclopedia Britannica, continuing on him, through the writings of one of the other early Catholic writers, a man named Irenaeus, who was in part trained by Polycarp, but moved to Gaul, that would be what is today France, and then later to Rome. So he is far more identified with the Western development, the Roman development of the church, even though this man had been in part trained by Polycarp. And this is the Encyclopedia's Britannica's account of that writer. I saw you when I was still a boy in Lower Asia in company with Polycarp. I can even now point out the place where the blessed Polycarp used to sit when he discoursed and described his goings out and comings in, his manner of life and his personal appearance in the discourses which he delivered to the people, how he used to speak on the intercourse with John and the rest of those who had seen the Lord, and how he would relate their words, everything that he had heard from them about the Lord, about his miracles, and about his teaching. Polycarp used to tell us, as one who had received it from those who had seen the word of life with their own eyes, and all this in perfect harmony with the scriptures. This is how Irenaeus described Polycarp. So they had contact when Irenaeus was a younger man. He was in part trained by Polycarp, but it would appear to me Irenaeus, frankly, departed from the faith and became heavily involved in the Western movement headquartered out of Rome. There were basically two movements at that time. Continuing in the Encyclopedia Britannica, though Polycarp must have been bishop of Smyrna for nearly half a century, we know next to nothing about his career. See, all these phrases keep cropping up, how little we know. Now, I'm spending two or three or four hours talking to you about this, but really I'm telling you almost everything. I'm reading almost all the material that you can gather together about this period of time. We only get an occasional glimpse of his activity, and the period between 115 and 155 is practically blank. As we know, he was working with John at the turn of the century as a young man, and we pick up the details of his death in the 150s in the accounts of history, but 115 to 155 is just nothing. That's a lot of years to know nothing about what was happening. The only points of sure information which we possess relate to, one, his relations with Ignatius, two, his protests against heresy, three, his visit to Rome in the time of Anicetus, which I'll tell you about next class, and four, his martyrdom, which I'll also tell you about next class. All through his life, Polycarp appears to have been an uncompromising opponent of heresy. We find him in his epistle, and there is an epistle of Polycarp. I have no objection to it. It isn't scripture, but it seems to be something that, you know, someone could have written. It is in the Ante-Nicene Fathers and reproduced in any number of works that you may choose to study. So if you want to browse through the Epistle of Polycarp, try to look it up and see if you have the time to do it. uttering a strong protest against certain false teachers, probably the followers of Cerinthus. Remember, he may have been involved in the confrontation of John and Cerinthus. Polycarp lived to see the rise of the Marcionite and Valentinian sects. Now, these are two little groups I'm not going to deal with, because there were many of them that started coming up that used Gnosticism and Christianity as a mixture, and sort of came up with this new religious thing, sect within the movement, and vigorously opposed it. Irenaeus tells us that on one occasion Marcion endeavored to establish relations with him and accosted him with the words, "Recognize us." Because Polycarp was no doubt recognized as the leading bishop of the church in that part of the world. This man is a wanted recognition by that man. Polycarp displayed the same uncompromising attitude which his master John had shown towards Cerinthus and answered, "I recognize you as the firstborn of Satan." That sounds like, I can hear one of God's ministers saying that all right enough. I'll go along with that. The steady progress of the heretical movement, in spite of all the opposition, was a cause of deep sorrow to Polycarp, so that the last years of his life, the words were constantly on his lips, "O good God, to what times have you spared me that I must suffer these things?" Because he saw the perversion of truth over a half a century of time before his death, and that he could do nothing to stem the tide. The heresy overtook the church, and he had to watch it occur and could do so little about it. Maintained the faith himself, but just was not a powerful enough figure to stem the tide of the rising church movement that came to be. So we'll pick it up with that then on next class, show you what was happening in the end years of Polycarp and his confrontation with Anicetus, the bishop at Rome.